Accession number 20612, Reel 4.
Bob Collins, Reel 4. And so you were saying that at Coburn's Path, you were working for the Fleet Air Arm.
Yeah.
Were any of the other Empire Lawrence people with you at Coburn's Path?
Yeah, two others. Two others from the Empire Lawrence, yeah.
Called, what was their name?
Eric Worthington and Reg Walker. Reg Walker still lives in Liverpool. Eric Worthington disappeared off the face of the earth. He went to America and became an American citizen somewhere around about the 50s. And I cannot find him because we went all through the war together, him and I. So he was drafted to the industrious, same as I was. So anyway, the only naval place we knew in Liverpool was the Liver Buildings, which was DEM's headquarters. So we went there and they made some inquiries and they found that Illustrious was going into Greenock. So we went up to Greenock, joined the Illustrious at Greenock. And the next day we sailed for Trincomalee, Ceylon.
What was your job in Illustrious?
Proper radar operator there. I was actually allocated to a watch. But we gained a lot more experience with the radar at Copath, the RAF stuff, although it was an entirely different type of set. But at least we got the fundamentals right. We knew how to operate a radar efficiently. So when aboard Illustrious, we were quite competent, really. Or fairly competent, not quite competent, fairly competent. But, so we were in the East Indies fleet. Did a number of operations. Burma. Andaman Islands. Malaya. It's bombing raids, Java, Sumatra, all bombing raids.
What do you remember about the operations?
We didn't get attacked a great deal by enemy planes, simply because I don't think the enemy knew we were there, where we were. Because we used to go about 100 miles, I suppose, of the enemy coast, fly the planes off, and they would attack whatever targets, oil refineries and railways and that sort of thing. And then they would fly back to us. Well, although the Japanese obviously knew we were there, they didn't know exactly where we were. So short of following the planes out, which they didn't often do, I think because they were lacking planes, and because they thought it was possibly, the attacks were, the East Indies fleet was brand new, they'd never been attacked before by enemy planes. So it was quite an eye-opener for them. So we got away with it, mostly. Occasionally they would find us. We would get attacked, but there were so many planes. I mean, we didn't go out just as a single carrier, not very often. We had Victorious. I think there were three carriers. We were later joined by others. So there were quite a few planes to cope with these few enemy planes that did come out to us. And then decided after about 11 months that we would be transferred, or part of the fleet, the East Indies fleet, would be transferred to the Pacific. So we now sail from Trincomalee On the way, we have an attack on Surabaya, which is Sumatra.
Java,
yeah. And Java's lower down at Sumatra, yeah. Yeah, anyway, we got paced in there. They did come out after us. And we had our first kamikaze attack. Now, I know it's debatable when it was a kamikaze attack, but it was a Bushido thing. He'd been shot down, and he was going to take somebody with him. So he dives at our stern. And what he actually did, he bent our centre shaft. There were three screws on there, Lustrious, and he bent the centre shaft. So we eventually get into Sydney, where they removed our, or blanked off our centre shaft. So we now only got two screws. Now, the rest of the fleet that had come with us had gone up into the Pacific to Manus, which was a base there. So we were having our screw, our centre shaft blanked off. So we go up off Queensland's coast and we do some exercises. For now we haven't got the speed, and the planes we had were notorious for landing. A Corsair, Vorsikorsky Corsair, which was a wonderful plane in the air, but it was a swine to land because the cockpit was too far back and they couldn't see the deck landing control officer's signal. So we lost quite a few planes in exercises mainly. So we're doing these exercises off Queensland's coast and we lost a number of planes, but I think it was decided on the pilots themselves that, yeah, they would go. Yeah, let's go, you know, we'll manage it. Well, they did become quite successful, even though our speed was reduced. So if we go up to Yap, I think it was, Ulithi or Yap, one of the piddling little islands that just been taken over by the Americans. Visited several of these little islands that just been taken over by the Americans. It was quite, you always do, because the first thing the Americans did when they captured the island or recaptured it, they built an airstrip on the beach, if there was a beach there, of course, and then they set up a radio station. So you will get, this is American broadcasting from Radio Yap, whatever the island was they captured. So you always knew what islands were being captured. And we had transmissions from them. Tokyo Rose, we used to listen to Tokyo Rose, which was, I think she was American, Japanese or something, and she was like Lord Haw Haw, you know. She used to broadcast telling the names of the ships. Although we weren't allowed to mention the name of our ship in the, not initially of what ship we were on, Tokyo Rose used to tell us, you know, who was up there. And eventually we were.
What else did she say?
Huh?
What else did she say?
Well, you know, to the Americans, mostly she was aiming at the Americans, and she would say that things that were going on in America that the American boys didn't know about, their wives running around with, other soldiers, and they may even mention names, you know, people's names, personal names, whether they were true or fictitious, well, I don't know, but she would mention names, say your wife is running around with such a person, you know. So he brought all this sort of stuff to, and things like 700 American troops have lost their lives in a battle for Tarawa or somewhere like that, you know. So it was all things to upset the Americans, but more than the British. So she was quite interested. You didn't believe it, but she was more convincing than Lord Haw-Haw, because Lord Haw-Haw, he had this voice. He had a particular voice. It was quite, you knew, always knew it was Lord Haw-Haw as soon as he opened his mouth. But Tokyo Rose was the girl next door type, you know? Though you didn't believe her, she was more convincing, I think, than the German propagandists. So anyway, we then form a fleet, and there are six carriers plus four battleships plus cruisers plus destroyers, and we make an impressive sight going into Leyte Gulf, Leyte, the Philippines. We got in line ahead formation, and we must have thought we were quite impressive. But unfortunately, when we got to Leyte, I think it was Leyte, it might have been before, it might have been Ulithi, I'm not too sure. Anyway, the American fleet starts to come out. And it's never ending. This is the American Third Fleet. And it's just carrier after carrier and battleship after battleship. And we're just sitting out there, mulling around sort of thing, waiting for them to come out before we go in. So anyway, we are based now at Leyte. But we go to several places like Yap and Ulithi and I can't remember some of the islands. And we are now attached to Task Force 27 under Mark Mischer, Mark Mischer, as a part of the American Third Fleet. And their engagement was Okinawa at that time. And we were to deploy our carriers on the islands between Formosa and Okinawa. They used a little island, Ryukyu's Sakishima group. Yeah, Sakishima. The little islands they use as bases of fueling planes so they can fly on. Our job was to knock these bases out. But of course, it was all rather futile because there are sand things, you know, built on the beach sort of thing. So they just filled them up. As soon as they got bombed, they just filled them up again. So we didn't really do anything substantial. We lost quite a few planes. We got attacked by kamikazes. We had another kamikaze. It was on my birthday, I think it was. My 21st birthday, 26th birthday, no, I can't remember now. But I was scared up there. I was really scared. In fact, I chickened out. I was in, say, with a radar cabin with a watch. But I could bring the planes in. I could pick up the planes and bring them in. But we had, in those days, what they call a ground wave. And this was a great chunk of signal of everything around you. And when they got into that ground wave, you couldn't see them. That was about 8 miles away. So when they got in that ground wave, I lost my nerve, and I had to say to somebody, can you take over here? Yeah, okay. They were very nice. So I thought, well, this is not really fair on these people. So I saw my divisional officer, and I told him the story, and he said, Oh, well, fair enough. He said, where would you think you'd be all right? So I said, in one of the turrets. Because we had 16 4.7s on the ship. Two in a turret. So he said, all right, I'll see what I can do. Well, nice fella. He found me a job in a turret for action stations. For action stations. But because action stations, you might be on 2 or 3 days at permanently at action stations off the island when you're off the islands. The fleet used to go in for about a week, and then it would come out, or half the fleet would go in for about a week, then it would come out for refuel, revittle, replace planes, and the other half would go in, and that's how you went about. So anyway, I finished up with this job in a turret, B2 ammunition handling, 4.7, humping those things about. I didn't mind, quite good. He didn't know what was going on in there. The first one, you were just sort of all up on edge. Then when that first one fired, you just kept helping to stuff this ammunition into the gun, and they could fire, I think, 12 rounds a minute into those barrels. So you were fully occupied. And, of course, you were in under armour plated and all this sort of thing, so if a kamikaze pilot did crash onto the turret, he'd probably bounce off anyway. So I was quite content in the turret. And that was it until we, say, got this kamikaze pilot. And he dived at us and he was going to... The prime objective of a kamikaze pilot on the American ships was between the island and the flight deck. The American carriers were wooden decks. We had, I think, 4 inches of armour plate on our flight deck. So they used to dive straight at the bridge after they found that diving on British carriers was a different story. Because I think it was the Indefatigable. One crashed on a flight deck and it made a big dent. But in actual fact, it assisted the planes taking off because they went down this dip and then they went up. They were, because you used to lose quite a lot of planes. Initially, when you set up the planes on a flight deck, the planes in the van, they still had a chance to have a short run on the flight deck, you see. And quite often, when they had a bomb load, for instance, you quite often see them go over the flight deck and drop down like this, and you never knew unless they didn't come up again. Quite often they didn't. They just dived straight into the sea because they didn't have those ramps in those days, you see. But say, on the Indefatigable, this actual dent in the flight deck helped the planes off, gave them get them in the air quicker. Done a bit of good on there, but there were men killed, of course. But the one that hit us, she was coming straight for the bridge. And here's another little story. The gun, it's a twin Oerlikon right underneath the bridge, at the front of the bridge, right underneath a twin Oerlikon. And one of the fellas who's manning the gun, the trainer, I think they called him the trainer. I think there were 3 crew on there. There was a captain of a gun, there was a layer, and a trainer, and an ammunition number. I can't remember. Anyway, this bloke saw this plane coming at him. He buggered off. Round the back of the island was a little companion way, just enough for a couple of people to pass, and he dived off behind there. But unfortunately, the skipper while all this is going on, I happen to see this go on from the bridge. Anyway, the captain of the gun dives into this fella's place, and he actually shoots off part of this jet plane's wing. So he's diverted the course of the plane from the bridge. In fact, it did, I think it did actually strike the bridge, but it went virtually straight over the side and exploded over the side. So we didn't suffer too much damage. Bits of body and bits of plane came back inboard, all this sort of thing. And I did actually pick up a piece of this Japanese plane. I can't remember what it was, a Zero or a Zeke or something. And it had, in fact, on this piece of metal, US Steel, a patent number. So we must have been supplying bits, or the Americans were supplying bits to them. But anyway, I didn't realise it at the time, but because of this damage that had been done to our centre shaft and the fact that this one had exploded over the side, sprung our plates. So it was just about the beginning of May. Indefatigable, implacable, I'm not too sure. Another courier came up. Indomitable, I think it was, came up. And we, she relieved us, and we came back out of the theatre of war. And I was off New Guinea on VE Day, and we fired off all our guns at a Feu de Joie, 212 barrels, all fired off tracer. Quite spectacular. I got a photo of it, actually, that was taken from an escort. Quite an impressive sight. And anyway, we get back to Sydney and offload all our planes and a lot of gear, and say this European war was over now. So we sailed straight across the Indian Ocean and dumping stuff over the side constantly. You know, that was part of my job, dumping stuff over the side, ammunition and all sorts of surplus stuff, you know, that wasn't required anymore. And we got back to Rosyth, came back to Rosyth. Then we had a choice now of either staying with a ship and completing her duties after we were repaired, going back out to the Pacific again, or leaving the ship and then perhaps joining another one and doing another commission. But most of us decided to stay with the ship. Well, I think everybody decided to stay with the ship. But actually, while I was home on leave, in the August, didn't get leave right away, not first part, the Japanese war finished, so that was it. So I just went back aboard Illustrious and waited for my demob papers to come, which came the next March.
Can I just go back to the Arctic convoys and the Empire Lawrence, please? And you said that when the ship was hit, it started to sink slowly. Can you just repeat what happened again about the abandoning of the ship, and then what happened, and how you went into the sea?
Yes, well, as I say, we got this first bomb, which went into number two hold, and the mate sounded the hold, and she was obviously in a sinking condition. So the skipper decides that we would abandon ship. Now, say she was going down, she was sinking, it was fairly obvious, but was given enough time to go back aft and put on some you know, warmer gear, for instance, thicker sea boot stockings, all that sort of thing, you know, and bits and pieces, cigarettes, and whatever we decided. So there were all sorts of things like pay books. Didn't bother with pay books, this sort of thing, or personal. I lost a solid silver cigarette case that went down with the ship, plus a signed photograph of Deanna Durbin. Remember Deanna Durbin?
Yes.
The singer? So there were all these little things that went down with the ship. And say, I went to my band ship station, which was a boat on the starboard side. And I was actually in this boat with some others, being lowered to the sea level, halfway down the ship, about halfway down the ship, where these four, I should imagine they were Stukas, because of the way they dived, they just peeled off and dived straight out. Some say there were five, some say there were four, but apparently four. I recall seeing four, definitely. And apparently these four bombs that they dropped did hit the ship. The port side suffered more than the starboard side, but I'm facing inboard to the ship, and it just separates with explosions into three pieces. So I saw the bows, and then a huge block of flame, and then the midsection where I was, and then the aft section, another sheet, great ball, burst of flame and explosion, and the ship is in three parts. Now, I don't know what happened after that, because the next thing I recall is coming up and actually coming out of the water, out of the sea, to the surface.
So you had intended to get into a lifeboat?
Yeah.
But you hadn't made it?
I was in the lifeboat, but it hadn't. There were no lifeboats left. They were just, you know, disintegrated. When the ship exploded, the lifeboats went with them. This is why I don't know what happened to me.
So you were in a lifeboat which hadn't been put into the sea?
Right. Yeah. When the ship just exploded. So from that point on, I don't know what happened, whether I was blown up in the air or sideways, or whether I went down with the ship, I just don't know.
And when you were in Russia, what impression did you get when you were ashore of places like Archangel?
Well, Murmansk, the people were, did spend a lot of time in Murmansk, but the people in Murmansk had a different mentality to the people around in Archangel. The women, particularly women, you didn't see a lot of men, particularly the women that you saw, were saying something in Russian, obviously, which was some remark directed to us. And one word you could get was capitalist. This was one word you could understand, because it's the same, virtually the same in Russian as it is in English. So you've got this message directed at you, an insult of some sort, I don't know. But around in Archangel, they were very friendly people. They're very nice. Now, contrary to what all the stories you read about the people, and the things that happen in these books, I tell you, I've read numerous books about, and I can always find something contradictory in most of them. People of Archangel were very friendly. I had a girlfriend in Archangel, Olya Putinovoy, and I met her in a cinema. Now, cinemas in Soviet Union were, you got one film, which was The Great Waltz, and I think this travelled all the way around Russia. numerous copies of this, are called A Great Waltz. And the rest of the programme consisted of war scene documentary. They were no hold barred. They weren't squeamish about what they showed in these newsreels. Mutilated bodies and people hanging and all this sort of thing. They didn't pull any punches. And I met this Les in this cinema. You bought